this, two horror legends meet and become friends. They put their collective heads together to create a horror anthology that pays homage to old comic books. Comic books that told grisly tales of murder and astonishing creatures. Bring in a special effects and makeup wizard, add a handful of familiar faces. What do you get? The absolute delight that is 1982's Creepshow.
Coming soon. Jolting tales of horror. Creepshow. From the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo. And the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. You'll scream at ghastly ghouls. Cringe at weird kids. And shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
This is going to be extremely painful, Mr. Verrill.
Creepshow will grab you, grow on you, and give you the creeps.
Oh, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
Creepshow, the most fun you'll ever have being scared.
I'm your host, Sherry, and this is just your friendly reminder that, as always, we'll be breaking down the plot in great detail. That means there will be loads of spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. Also, it's from 1982, so I feel like spoilers are fair game at this point. Otherwise, proceed at your own risk. And joining us to talk about this 1982 classic are Crystal, John, and Steve. Hey, folks, how is everybody doing tonight?
Great.
It's fabulous.
I can hold my breath a long, long time.
I'm asthmatic, so I cannot.
So, do any of you remember the first time you saw a Creepshow?
Yep, you bet I do. that's why when you said Creepshow, I was like, oh yes, because this film, well, to put it mildly, it made an impression on me. I saw this at the age of 9, and it broke me at that age.
That's a perfect age to watch this.
How old do you think the kid is in the movie? Because I'm wondering, was I older or younger than that kid, or about that age? Anyway, this is not a movie for a 9-year-old.
Oh no!
It gave me nightmares. It's hard to. I want to say for months, maybe it was days, but it feels like for a long, long, long time.
Like best case scenario, you just like see how nightmarish marriage can be.
Oh God.
It does not depict marriage in a happy light, that is for sure.
It really doesn't. That's not the part that got to me as a 9-year-old. But it's true nonetheless.
Oh, the horrors of real life.
I don't remember the first time I saw this exactly, but I think it was on late night WGN here in Chicago. Just stumbled across it because I didn't remember rewatching it the other day. I didn't remember the first segment. Or the wraparound segments, but every once in a while, I will think back to baby Ted Danson buried up to his neck in sand, and it was so that just like haunted me because it was like these two funny guys were in this horrific story.
And before the sand, he was buried up to his neck in chest hair.
I mean, it was the 80s.
Who wore it best, Ted Danson or Huey Lewis in the News?
Ted Danson.
I think we're all just going to go with Ted Danson.
Yeah. Crystal, do you remember the first time you saw it?
I'm the worst. I never remember them because I watched them so many times. Like as a kid, I would finish a movie, rewind it, and watch it immediately again. I don't know. The first one didn't stick with me as much as the second Creepshow, I feel.
Oh, okay.
So I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I just remember watching it a few times in a row, probably.
this was one of those like 80s staples on HBO. Like people my age in their mid 40s are just, you know, I didn't have cable, but like friends, I brought up Creepshow and they're like, oh yeah. And then they would bring up like Just One of the Guys. And I forget what the other one was. Thor, You're the Hunter, maybe some weird thing I had never heard of. But apparently I have to watch that because my boss told me to now because he loved it as a kid.
Just One of the Guys was one of my favorites growing up. I loved that movie.
I mean, talk about making an impression on people. An entire generation of straight men remember that movie.
Crystal, you referenced this, though, in our very first episode.
I did. And I think that might be because I loved Leslie Nielsen so very much. Mm. He is born in Regina, Saskatchewan, so very near and dear to my heart.
All right.
So the Letterboxd summary, inspired by the EC comics of the 1950s, George A. Romero and Stephen King bring five tales of terror to the screen. So this was actually Stephen King's screenwriting debut, and it was directed by George A. Romero. And it started because apparently, according to an interview in Electric Sheep magazine from 2014, Romero was asked about getting into adaptation and making films like Creepshow, Creepshow 2, and The Dark Half. And he said what attracted him to this was being comfortable with Stephen himself. He said, we became friends. We were introduced by Warner Brothers years before because they had seen Martin. And in typical studio fashion, they reasoned that Martin was about a vampire in a small town. Steve had just written Salem's Lot, which was vampires in a small town. So they thought we should meet. They sent me up to Maine and we hung out. My doing an adaptation of that book never happened. But on that visit, Steve gave me a copy of The Stand and said, let's make this. And I said, sure. Which they soon realized they didn't have the budget to do justice to The Stand, and then decided, you know what, we both really like comic books, we really like EC comics, so let's do a comic book anthology. And when asked, Stephen King said he could write a script in 60 days, and sure enough, on day 60, he delivered the script for Creepshow.
I just like the idea of them deciding to do The Stand kind of on a whim.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no kidding. So the film was primarily shot on location in Pittsburgh and its suburbs, including at an abandoned school. The school was converted into a film studio where they shot the segments, The Lonesome Death of Geordie Beryl and They're Creeping Up on You, as well as the prologue and epilogue. The Crate was mostly shot at Carnegie Mellon University, where Romero actually went to school, with Margaret Morrison Hall serving as Amberson Hall. And the backyard party was filmed in Romero's own backyard.
Oh, cool.
On Amberson Avenue. Special effects and makeup by legend Tom Savini, who also makes an appearance in the film, which we'll talk about later. And it was released on May 16th, 1982 at the Cannes Film Festival, and then on November 10th, 1982 in wide release. It was also the only George A. Romero film to open at number one for the weekend box office.
Well, this is the one he's remembered for, right?
The budget was $8 million and box office was $31 million. Roger Ebert, generally not a fan of horror movies, gave the film 3 out of 4 stars and wrote, Romero and King have approached this movie with humor and affection, as well as with an appreciation for the macabre.
I like that. Affection.
Right? Affection. And it does come across as very much a love letter to the comic books that they like. Some of the reviews not so good. For the New York Times, Vincent Canby wrote, the best things about Creepshow are its carefully simulated comic book tackiness and the gusto with which some good actors assume silly positions. Horror film purists may object to the levity, even though failed, as a lot of it is. Gary Arnold in the Washington Post wrote, what one confronts in Creepshow is five consistently stale, derivative horror vignettes of various lengths and defects. Maybe this was geared towards you, John. In his review for Time, Richard Corliss wrote, the jolts can be predicted by any 10-year-old with a stopwatch.
See, I was 9. That's where I failed.
Yeah, if you'd only been 1 year older.
A buck short.
Okay, so before we get started, I'm going to ask you, how would you rank the 5 stories in Creepshow?
Okay, who's going first?
I guess I can. I would definitely go Something to Tide You Over. That, to me, was like the standout. Because gleefully evil Leslie Nielsen really was effective. Then maybe Father's Day, and They're Creeping Up on You, and The Crate. And then, I'm sorry, but The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill is It's a Muppet stuffed with cocaine and let loose in a farm.
You're not wrong.
Not wrong. In fact, I'm going to agree with every single one of those ranking. Tide You Over for me is a million light years above, because that is the movie that broke my young brain. And then next to that was Father's Day, because I remember that being like absolutely horrifying and terrifying beyond my ability to even imagine or express as a child. And then everything else was just kind of not that scary, with Geordi being actually boring for me, even as a 9-year-old.
Yeah, mine's pretty darn close to the same.
See, because I stepped up and did it first, you all copied me.
I thought somebody was going to do the cockroaches one on top, for sure.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Geordi Verrill is my favorite. I'm just kidding. I just thought I'd stick up for it, but it is definitely the weakest.
They're all great. They're all very fun. I just, I would have respected your choice.
So polite, Crystal. So we open on a pretty typical American house, probably in suburbia. It's nighttime and we can hear this father lecturing his son about his choice of reading material. And the dad is played by Tom Atkins. He's reading garbage, his dad says. But the son, played by Joe Hill, a.k.a. Joe King, Stephen King's son, throws his choice of reading materials back in his face, saying, "They're no worse than the sex books you read." Not surprisingly, that doesn't go too well, and Dad slaps him across the face.
And leaves a mark the size of, like, a small car.
True.
That lingers for the rest of the scene.
Yeah.
Undeterred, Dad goes outside to throw the comic book out. And this prop 10-cent Creepshow comic book was drawn and inked by one of the artists for the original EC crime and horror comics of the 1950s, named Jack Kamen. Meanwhile, Mom is a little more lenient. She's like, "You might just be overreacting." And we get a little hint of some of the stories we're about to hear. When the dad says, "Do you want our son reading about monsters in crates, dead people coming back to life, people turning into weeds?" I mean, all of those sound pretty interesting to me. So I'm like, yeah, I would love to read about that. And I know it's the 80s, but when he tells his wife that he took care of it because that's why God made fathers, babe. That's why God made fathers.
Delivery.
Can I ask really quick what movie everybody first thinks of when they see Tom Atkins? Because he's been in a ton of horror movies. Like, he's been in a ton of movies in general, but like for me, it's Night of the Creeps, which I saw for the first time like 2 years ago. And I was just wondering, like, Halloween 3, The Fog, anything?
Mine would probably be Halloween 3.
Yeah, that's kind of the only thing that pops into my head first of all.
Yeah, and you got me because, yeah, I didn't recognize him, even though I'm a huge horror movie buff, but he didn't jump out at me as like, oh yeah, him. No, just some guy.
Lack of mustache. In
this one. 100%, yeah.
Yes.
I think if you were to ask me what my favorite would be, it would probably be Night of the Creeps.
Okay.
That's probably my favorite Tom Atkins role. But I would say I think of him first from Halloween 3, probably because that's the first movie that I would have seen him in.
Oh, okay.
Back upstairs, Billy is cursing his father, saying, "I hope you rot in hell," for seeing the creep outside his window. Now, when I was that age, I would have lost my mind.
Right, but this is Stephen King's son and was bred for horror, so.
It did remind me of the little kid floating outside the window in Salem's Lot.
Yes, totally. Uh-huh.
First, we get a close-up of the creep, and the film does the thing that it's going to do throughout the movie, where it transitions to animation. We see the opening credits, which are really cool. So now we're going to talk a little bit about Father's Day. So this is ranked number 2 for pretty much everybody, right?
Mm-hmm. This is number 2? Yeah. I think this was everybody's number 2.
Maybe it's because we just went from one bad father to another. From the
I feel like this father is the worst, though. Nathan Grantham is probably a worse father than Tom Atkins.
Just give him time. He's still young.
We see 4 family members having tea, very civilized. We have Sylvia, her nephew Richard, her niece Cass, and Cass's husband Hank, played to perfection by Ed Harris. They're waiting for great Aunt Bedelia, who, family rumor has it, murdered her father.
Is it a rumor?
Well,
alleged.
Although I think maybe to like Cass and Richard, it's a rumor. Like we later learn that Sylvia knows.
So Cass is the did she tell Ed Harris
the hog of a niece?
Yes, he married a hog. Like everybody in this family except for Ed Harris's character is pretty monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
They're awful to each other.
Yes.
We learn that Nathan Grantham was a rich, cantankerous old man. He called his family dirty vultures, and I'm sure probably other things as well. So he probably wasn't super popular in the family. And Bedelia basically nursed her father after he had a stroke. Things became a little more complicated, as they often do when Bedelia fell in love. Her father, clearly not the kindest and most well-meaning of men, had Yarbrough, her foe, as they call him, killed. So, but remember, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree usually, so Bedelia got her revenge, bashing her father's head in with a marble ashtray.
I mean, it feels like he kind of pushed her, though. Like,
oh my god, he called her a dirty bitch.
Like, yes, and also, is Father's Day cake a thing?
That's true! No, I've never heard of that before. My dad has never expected a cake.
No, my dad just wants like a Home Depot gift card.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if you're part of the 1%, like it is a thing.
He's rich enough to have cake every day.
Well, that's true. That is true.
In a world where people's names are Bedelia, you can have Father's Day cake. We're suspending disbelief.
Why is Bedelia the one baking the cake? Can't they shop that out? Like, why?
Yeah. I was a little distracted because I watched this on a service with ads, and this is where they cut into a Taco Bell commercial. So it was very strange.
Where's my chalupa? So take a close look at that ashtray, because we're going to see it again throughout the movie. In fact, we see it in every segment of the movie from here on out.
That's true. Good tip for any would-be murderers. Definitely keep the murder weapon around and in full sight.
Do you think the maid got a raise after she saw her employer get murdered by her daughter?
That's what I was thinking. They do not give Mrs. Danvers enough respect. I can't believe she's still even working for them.
My note after she was after he was murdered was, how was she acquitted? And it's a blunt force trauma to the head. He was in a wheelchair. He had a cane. Sorry, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Maybe they didn't even report it. Maybe they just buried him in the back cemetery and called it a day.
Maybe this year was a cake for Father's Day and the previous year was a headstone.
Yeah. Maybe. Nobody was terribly broken up about Nathan's death, but we learned that for the past 7 years, every Father's Day, Bedelia comes back to the family manor, I guess. She has a routine. First, she'll visit her father's grave for about an hour before they all sit down to a nice ham dinner. Bedelia is described as unstable, you think. And the way that Vivica Lindforce, the actress that plays her, I just think she looks like a hoot.
Mm-hmm.
She's the eccentric aunt that, you know, all the kids want to hang out with and hear stories from, except that she's murderous, so maybe you don't.
And I did love her version of meditation at the grave, which was just... Yeah. Yelling, drinking, and she's the only one with an accent.
So she arrives at the cemetery, the back cemetery, as Crystal calls it, because it literally is on the property. And she's looking at her father's grave from a distance. We hear an elderly voice say, "Where's my cake?" She approaches the grave, which looks way older than 7 years, by the way. So maybe you're right about the gravestone being a previous Father's Day present. And we see shots of the fateful day as he is berating Bedelia. He is repeatedly asking for his cake, banging his cane against his chair. And Bedelia angrily icing that cake is a definite mood. Like, at first she's very careful, and then she's just like piling the icing on.
I mean, he didn't say he wanted his neatly decorated cake. I would have just brought it out.
So the housekeeper, as we mentioned, Mrs. Danvers, she's a witness to this abuse. I'm going to guess that if he treats his daughter like this, he probably doesn't treat the servants very well, which might be why Mrs. Danvers was like, "I'll help you cover it up."
Oh, yeah.
Bedelia enters the dining room. She picks up that ashtray and wishes her dear old dad a happy Father's Day as she whacks him in the head with the ashtray. Back in the present, she approaches Nathan's grave. We hear a mourning dove cooing, which, according to various spiritual beliefs, witnessing or hearing a mourning dove means that you're being watched or being visited by a loved one who passed away. She sits down on the ground. As we talked about, she takes out a bottle of whiskey and she is cursing him. This is her version of meditation. And she recounts his crimes against her. Apparently, Vivica Lindfors asked George A. Romero if she could improvise the scene at the tomb. And to do so, she thought about her relationship with her own father and her ex-husband.
Yikes. So was the whiskey chugging real?
That was some cloudy Jim Beam. I gotta say, if it was real, then shame on her for spilling half of it onto the lawn.
We learn that Sylvia helped cover up the murder, so she wasn't caught. Although, like you said, I don't know how they explained away the blunt force trauma.
Yeah.
He fell and hit the ashtray.
He slipped into times. This grave. Yeah.
I mean, don't discount slipping into a grave. We see it happen.
This is true. And no desire to get out. I was just wondering why does he burst out of the grave now? Like,
why not last year?
Yeah, why is the seventh year? Like, I don't know. I don't know. Did he smell cake that they were having later?
So it was that extra icing that really put it over the top. He wouldn't have smelled it otherwise.
Well, whiskey is known as the water of life. Maybe the whiskey brought him back to life.
Maybe. So if it was a nicer whiskey, he would have been like in better shape, I guess.
Exactly. So Nathan digs himself out of his grave in a gravelly, deep voice. I feel like, Crystal, you should do this impression because you're so good at them.
Oh, not this one. Where's my cake, Bedelia?
That was pretty good.
Oh, I have chills.
So he strangles her on his own grave and reminds her that it's Father's Day and he wants his cake. Back at the ancestral home, the clock strikes 7. Cass and Hank are dancing around the room. And I feel like we need to take a moment and talk about Ed Harris's dance moves.
Oh, and the tightest jeans in creation.
How does he dance in those jeans?
I don't know.
I want to know who would win in a dance-off, Ed Harris in Creepshow or Crispin Glover in Friday the 13th Part 4?
That's why God created blue jeans.
I think Crispin Glover would win.
Yeah. If nothing else, it's so inventive. Is this the way you celebrate your in-laws confessing to murder or to being accessories to murder, just by dancing?
I guess. He's got to get his feelings out somehow.
I guess.
When in Rome.
Sylvia is a little concerned because normally she says you can set your watch by Bedelia and she's always at the house for 6 for that ham dinner. So Hank heads outside for a smoke. He starts to walk towards the cemetery. He calls out to Bedelia, and when she doesn't answer, because also if she was alive, why would she answer? She's never met Hank. She hears a random male calling her name in a cemetery when it's the anniversary of a murder.
Seeing him light matches on anything while he wanders around.
Right. Right. That's his thing, isn't it? I can light a match off anything.
It's perfect. It's the anniversary of murder. There's a full moon. There's mist in the cemetery. And he starts to hear these noises. He's hearing creaking footsteps, which really should be red flags, but he's distracted. His foot hits the discarded Jim Beam bottle and he picks it up. And I'm sorry, you don't just pick up an open discarded bottle in a cemetery and take a sip.
No.
You're asking to be cursed.
100%. He stumbles, he falls down into an open grave. And like we said, he has no sense of urgency. Doesn't really feel the need to get up, even as the monument above him shifts.
Like, he's in shape. He could do a sit-up. He could get out of the way.
He really could. He grabs something for leverage, and it turns out to be Aunt Bedelia's arm. And he doesn't scream when she practically rolls over onto him.
I mean, he doesn't even try to get out again. Like, it's if the shifting tombstone and the dead body next to you don't motivate you to flee the scene, I don't know what will.
It's funny that he didn't notice Aunt Bedelia's body there before. Yeah. That seems like a plot hole.
We now see the gravestone continue to shift. We see a man's shadow cast on it. And he looks up and he sees Nathan's zombie. Is Nathan a zombie? I guess he's a zombie. Standing in front of him. He's using some kind of telekinetic powers to move the gravestone.
Yeah.
Zombies can do that. That's a fact. That's science.
Yeah, that grave was under the influence of Jim Beam, so it was unsteady.
but it crushes poor Hank. Which Hank hasn't done anything to this family. I don't know. I feel bad for him.
I wrote that down. What did Ed Harris do?
Right. By the rules of horror, shouldn't he be the one to live? Because he's not, you know, full of sin and all that. He drank the whiskey. There you go. There you go.
Man, if I see an open bottle outside, best case scenario, it's whiskey, but I'm not going to test it out.
No. Nathan is not distracted. He's still very fixated on his cake. But back at the manor, the family is getting impatient. Cass wants to know where her husband is, and she wants her dinner.
And she's dancing by herself the whole time, like, just having a party.
Sylvia heads into the kitchen. She's looking for Mrs. Danvers, and she sees these muddy footprints on the ground before you get the classic horror movie reveal, and Mrs. Danvers' face slumps against the window in the door. And Sylvia freaks out, turns to see a putrefied Nathan demanding cake before he takes her head in his hands and decapitates her. But the night is not over yet. We still have Richard and Cass, and Cass is becoming increasingly more worried, and she just wants Richard to go look for Hank. He reluctantly agrees. The two of them head into the kitchen where once again we see the muddy footprints. They're about to go through the set of double doors and they are confronted by their reanimated ancestor. And he has cake for them because it's Father's Day and that's what you do on Father's Day and Father's Day, apparently. Except that the cake is Sylvia's head on a platter with some icing and candles on top.
Not delicious.
I loved the candles. So if we don't have cake on Father's Day, we definitely don't have birthday candles on a Father's Day.
That's true.
He finally got his cake. He couldn't be happier. We return to animation as Cass and Richard scream.
I did write down that in the comic book frame it goes to that they are saying gag and arg.
There's something about zombie voice like that. I don't know what that effect is. I even tried to find out because I really, really wanted to know what effect they put on his voice to make it so ragged and rotten. Because that got me as a child. Like that voice, I think maybe even more than anything else about that character, that's what got me. I wish I knew, actually. I can't figure it out. If any of you know how they did that, I would love to know.
No idea. But it's right, a very good, yeah, it's a very good zombie voice.
So do Cass and Richard die?
I thought they were going to have some cake.
Yeah, maybe he was satisfied and just went back to sleep.
So food poisoning is what you're saying. They died of food poisoning.
Before we move on to the next story, we see the letters page in the comic book and we see, you know, just like typical horror fans, they want to see more nauseating rubbish. Keep it coming. Next up, we have the story that we unanimously agreed is the weakest of the stories. However, it has its merits. The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill. So it stars Stephen King. And Romero directed King to play Jordy like Wile E. Coyote, the way he looks when he goes off a cliff. So a lot of people were like, man, Stephen King's really overacting in this, but that was the point. So one night, Jordy Verrill standing outside in a farm field, and he sees a meteor come crashing to the ground. Now, Jordy isn't the smartest man, and he touches the still glowing meteor with his bare fingers.
And then puts them in his mouth.
But then he starts thinking, how much money could I get for this? Imagine showing up at the college, the Department of Meteors.
I love that. Oh.
Where he's like, I'm going to hold firm. I'm going to get $200 for this meteor. He thinks that the scientist, the professor, is going to try and like talk him down. But he's like, no, I'm going to hold firm. I'm going to get this $200.
And he says that $200 will pay off a bank loan. And I just want to know what he bought that he financed $200.
His TV.
Oh, true.
That's just my random guess.
Yeah.
And we see the ashtray, the murder weapon, next to the cash box at the Department of Meteors.
This reminded me of Joe Dirt. You remember when he found that that poop that fell from the airplane and he thought it was a meteor and he took it to be like...
Somehow I missed Joe Dirt.
I blocked it out, I think.
I'll just keep that one to myself.
He realizes that he can't touch the meteor again without burning his hands some more. And so he pours water on the meteor. But this doesn't go quite according to his plan. The meteor cracks open and it releases a whole lot of vapor. Poor Jordy revisits his fantasy, but this time the scientist mocks him for bringing a broken meteor. No $200 now, Jordy. Verrill luck is always in, he says. You spell that kind of luck, B-A-D. But he's not ready to give up. He picks up the pieces of the meteor. He even thinks, he's like, maybe I'm going to like, I'll glue it back together tomorrow. But he dumps the liquid content, aka meteor shit, into the crater, getting some on his hands as well. The liquid glows in a way that isn't exactly reassuring.
No.
Has there ever been a movie where a meteor brought something good to Earth?
That's a good question.
I mean, I know I'm kind of like probably one-sided in my views because I see like, I watch horror movies and sci-fi movies and they're never going to be something good. No.
I mean, it depends on your definition of a, well, I don't know. Meteor is pretty solid. So like, you know, it's not like Superman came in a meteor or Mork, you know, like those are my two aliens that I always go to, you know, I don't know. For some reason, those are the two I thought of, but yeah, I don't think so. I can't think of anything that, you know, like that opens up and there's just like, you know, cash and fireworks.
And cake.
Cake, definitely.
So Jordy heads back into the house. It's time for beer and wrestling. Meanwhile, the meteor shit is doing its thing and some otherworldly greenery has started to sprout around the farm and on Jordy's fingertips. Ugh. Jordy has a very active imagination and he starts to call the doctor but then imagines what the outcome would be, amputated fingers. The fact that he thinks that the doctor would do it in the office with a cleaver, telling him almost gleefully that it's going to be very painful.
Plus, he has, like, a Mayberry phone, and it made me wonder when this is supposed to take place.
Right.
I was going to say, what year do we think this takes place? First of all, $200 loan.
He's got a big honking TV.
Yep.
Black and white, though, right? Yeah.
Black and white.
Well, it's a big TV, but it's a small screen.
1950? Yeah. 1950?
Did universities have Department of Meteor Studies in 1950s?
Yep. Oh. Well, let me Google it. Okay. Clack, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. Yep, they did.
Jordy snaps back to reality as he realizes that he had put his fingers in his mouth. And sure enough, the greens have started to sprout on his tongue.
So far, the moral of this movie is don't put things in your mouth, right? Don't drink the whiskey.
Yeah.
Don't lick the meteor.
And ask for cake politely.
And be polite, yes. for the love of God.
So the greenery is spreading very quickly on the farm, around the house, on Jordy. And Stephen King actually had an allergic reaction to the makeup he had to wear for this transformation. So he had to take shots, medication, so that he could actually get through shooting. Jordy is astonished to see how much the plants have spread. And for some reason decides that a screwdriver, the drink, not the hand tool, is what he needs. Drinking it right out of the pitcher as he watches a preacher on TV. And you can literally hear the rustling of the plants growing. He wakes up in his chair. He thinks, oh, it was all a dream. And then he sees the state of his living room, which is covered in green. He heads for the bathroom. He runs a bath to help with the incessant itch and is absolutely distraught when he sees that the green has spread everywhere on his body.
His bathing suit area, if you will.
We've all been, yes, there.
Well,
am I right?
Sure.
I mean, I don't mean recently. I mean back in university.
Oh, okay.
He's then interrupted by a vision of his dead father, and his father's like, it wants some water, don't have a bath, Jordy. But Jordy's like, I'm gonna die anyway, and he ends up falling into the bathtub. The next morning, Jordy and the house are pretty much covered in the plants. He's basically transformed into a plant monster. So he gets a hold of his shotgun, he prays that his luck is in before shooting himself in the head.
Really ending on a sad note. Kind of a buzz.
Still. It is sad. Yeah. It is really sad. They did accomplish that. I read something that this is supposed to be some kind of homage to Color Out of Space.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah, like I wouldn't have thought of that on my own. I read that as a comment online and I thought, oh, kind of, yeah.
I can see that. I mean, that's pretty much what happens, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We hear the weather report on the TV. The forecast is for lots of rain, which bodes well for the new foliage in town. And when the weatherman says Castle County will turn green so fast in the next month that it's going to be almost miraculous, you're like,
yeah,
maybe not miraculous. But we transition to animation again as we get a shot of a directional sign telling us exactly how far we are from the famous town of Castle Rock in the Stephen King universe, before we see the comic in the garbage, the wind rustling the pages to open to an ad for a voodoo doll and other novelties. And now we're going to talk about everybody's favorite, Something to Tide You Over.
Yay.
I thought this would be nobody else's favorite.
Me too.
Because it's the one that seems to get the least love on the internet.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
What is it, the crate, or is it They're Creeping Up on You that gets the most love on the internet?
I think They're Creeping Up gets the most love.
So Something to Tide You Over starts in a very chic apartment. Well, chic for the 1980s. So what was with the 80s and the glass and wood combo for furniture?
There was a lot of notes I made. Like, there's one scene in Leslie Nielsen's place. He has those brass cranes on his coffee table. And I was like, oh, man, everyone had those.
I mean, he also has a velour tracksuit.
Yes, the velour tracksuit and the statement necklace.
Yeah.
That was fun.
That necklace is amazing. So we see Harry Wentworth, played by Ted Danson, sleeping on his couch before being woken by a knock at the door. And actually, one of the things that I thought of when I saw this opening scene when I watched it again was, where is the TV pointed at? Because no matter which loveseat or couch you're sitting on, you're not watching that TV. The TV's just randomly pointing into the middle of the room, but there's no seating around the TV.
I thought, by Jove, Ted Danson was a handsome guy. I mean, that is a handsome, handsome guy.
He really was.
Really, like, phenomenally handsome guy.
That hair.
Yeah, the hair's good.
That jawline. Are you kidding me?
The visitor at the door is Richard, played by Leslie Nielsen, who tells him that if he doesn't let him in and talk with him, something terrible is going to happen to a woman named Rebecca. We learn that Becky and Harry have been having an affair, and Becky's husband, Richard, a.k.a. Leslie Nielsen, has found out. Richard doesn't seem to be too broken up about it, though. Instead, he's showing a little more concern about Harry's TV setup, the general care of the TV.
Yeah, that was weird.
But he's very obsessed with technology. Like, he likes his TVs and VCRs and cameras. It's a little disconcerting when he says that he keeps what's his, but it's Leslie Nielsen. I mean, he's not a bad guy, right? Like, look at his cardigan. Like, that's not a bad guy cardigan.
Look at his grin.
Was Leslie Nielsen ever in anything where he was a bad guy before? Like, I can't think of anything that I've seen him in where he was a bad guy.
Oh, pretty much everything before Airplane. He was.
Oh, really?
Maybe not a bad guy, but he played the heavy several times, and he was a dramatic actor. That was his first really comedic role, and one of the reasons he did so well is because he played it straight, I think. Like, it was a drama.
Leslie Nielsen, total side note, with a little Canadian history. Leslie Nielsen's brother was once Deputy Prime Minister of Canada.
Did he start off meetings with a fart machine?
No. Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that much about my Deputy Prime Minister.
I think that would be taught in the history classes, though.
Probably. He just wants to show Harry a video. And he just has this very subtle air of menace at this point. He plays this mini cassette recording of Becky begging Harry to come to her rescue. And we're like, well, what has he done with her? So Richard says, let's go for a drive and you'll find out. So they head to the beach at Comfort Point, and we see Richard's extravagant beach house in the distance. And he is practically jubilant. Like, he's like almost skipping across the dunes. He's beckoning to Harry, the knight in shining corduroy, as he calls him.
I love that.
Which is probably one of my favorite lines.
It's pretty great.
And then he points out a shovel and a mound of sand in the distance. Harry, of course, thinks the worst. He runs towards it, but he only finds a pit dug in the sand. He grabs the shovel. He turns back towards Richard, but Richard is ready with a gun. Richard tells Harry to jump in the hole or he will shoot him. And then when Harry does, he tells him to pull the sand in around him. He's like, I only want to incapacitate you, and then I'll let you see Becky. And of course, as you would do, Harry starts screaming, but Richard reminds him that literally no one else is around. Like, you're on my private beach in front of my home. There's no point in screaming. Nobody's going to hear you.
Which he named his home Comfort Station.
Yes. Isn't that awesome?
That's kind of awesome.
What would you name your home, Crystal?
Well, now it has to be Comfort Station. I wouldn't be able to think of anything better than that.
I just named mine Otis. I do love how gleefully evil Leslie Nielsen is being. Just so smarmy. And
it's so good. Yeah. It's so good. I like when he starts yelling too.
Oh, it's such a great moment.
Yell all you like. Help, help. It's so good.
And he plays with him. He's like, I could bury you all the way. And then he pushes sand into his face before him being like, just kidding. I keep my promises. And not only does Harry now have to deal with Richard, he has killer crabs to deal with. Well, really one crab that, but honestly, imagine you're buried in sand, only your head is free, and a crab comes waltzing up to you. I would scream. I'd be freaked out.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Nick your little nose.
Exactly. So Richard returns to the beach with his Jeep, and he sets up a TV so that Harry can finally see Becky. Something to take your mind off things, he says. He is twisted.
I just wrote down right now, wireless would help.
Becky has also been buried in the sand, but the tide is further down the beach. The tide is coming in and things don't look very good for her. Harry thinks it's a trick, but Richard's like, no, I assure you it's not. But who carries a generator around in their car for moments when you need a TV and VCR on the beach?
Yeah, like, does he do this a lot?
That moment of seeing her on the TV, like, struggling, there was something there that, like, it felt suddenly very real. Like, I wasn't watching a horror movie. Like, it almost felt like a snuff film. I was a child. This is the moment that broke me. But it felt very, very real, like it was like a closed-circuit TV kind of thing. I believed it.
Yeah, it's got a found footage documentary kind of.
Yeah.
The menace is amping up, and there's something about Leslie Nielsen's voice when he's talking about how cold and salty that water is that just, like, is terrifying.
These were legitimately great performances by these two. Mm-hmm.
They were.
He continues to mentally torture Harry before commenting on the tide coming in front of them now. So he's like, enjoy the show. I'm out of here. And Harry has to watch the woman he loves die in front of him, knowing that his fate is probably going to be the same. Despite Richard telling him, you just have to hold your breath. You can probably get out of this. You just have to hold your breath and the tide will take you away. So the waves start crashing in around him. Richard's heading home to his beautiful beach house, which is surrounded by security cameras. And from here, he can watch what's happening to Becky and Harry. And he is reveling in it until Harry looks right at the camera and says, I'm going to get you, Richard. And then we get that shot of Harry's head underwater and the red glow behind him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the tide goes back out. Richard heads to the beach to retrieve his equipment. And he's like, the current must have pulled Harry out to sea because his body's not there. The sun begins to set and we see footprints leading out from the ocean. So later that night, Richard's lying in bed, he's watching TV, and he decides to pull out one of his home movies. And in case you're watching, that ashtray now on the nightstand next to Richard's bed.
This is where you said how many wives has he had before this? And it's like when he had that wall of homemade tapes that weren't really labeled, I was like, I wonder if those are all like murders.
Oh.
Like, what shall I watch tonight?
Oh my gosh. I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
He hears someone say his name, but there's no one there. So he looks outside, he pulls aside the curtains, and he turns back into the room. And we see some shadowy figures move on the other side of the curtain. And he's not worried. He's like, no need to get jumpy. He tells himself and he runs a shower. He really should be paying attention to all those security cameras, though.
Especially if he doesn't know if Danson got out or not.
Yeah, he just assumes he was taken out to sea.
I mean, we saw two sets of footprints walking in the sand, so we know Jesus wasn't involved.
Well, I'm scratching out all the rest of my notes. Thanks for that.
You're welcome. I mean, I am available for kids' parties, mostly because I like balloon animals and cake.
Like real cake. Like,
yes. No, not Father's Day cake. Not severed head cake, which I assume is a traditional Father's Day cake.
We see something enter the house, something so dreadful that it scares all the poor fish in Richard's aquarium. And we see two figures. They are covered in seaweed. They are squelching as they make their way through the house, accompanied by a requisite ghostly fog. Richard's starting to get nervous. He gets out of the shower, he grabs his gun, and he's starting to second guess his theory about the current taking Harry out to sea. But I don't think the gun's going to do him much good. And he opens his like double bedroom doors to reveal the gnarly corpses of Becky and Harry. John, this must have terrified you when you were 9 as well.
This is good makeup, but once again, it was the idea of being buried up to my neck in wet cement that did it for me. Because it just, the idea of the paralysis, that was it. The zombies, terrifying, sure, but it was the torture part that got me.
Fair enough. They tell him, you can't shoot us dead, Richard, because we're already dead. And the sound design and lighting in this scene is just perfect.
And even the costuming is actually pretty good. I mean, the swollen features and everything, like, they got it that time, I think.
When he shoots him in the head and that, like, the dirty water comes out.
The black stuff, yeah.
Oh, that was great.
Apparently, Ted Danson said that his daughter was on the set during the scene where Harry returns from the dead, and he tried to avoid her because he didn't want to scare her. But finally, she went up to him and was just like, hey, Dad. So he's like, okay, then. So they come towards him. They tell him that they've dug a hole for him, and he just continues to shoot at them. But that obviously doesn't do anything.
But throwing the gun at them will. So he has such a fancy house, but such a basic bathroom.
Yeah, like the lock is just like a little, I don't even know what those are called.
And his shower was just like something you'd see like in a, I don't know, just like a sad one bedroom apartment.
The tub was great though.
Oh, that's true.
But he doesn't use it.
No. I bet Rebecca did.
Oh, poor Rebecca. And the way that they keep repeating what he said to them is delightful. Like, I think they keep repeating, you just have to hold your breath, Richard. You just have to hold your breath. And, you know, with all the Buddhas he has around the house, you'd think that he would know a thing or two about karma.
True.
He does manage to escape, but only temporarily. And they keep repeating, if you can hold your breath. He's laughing hysterically before we see him buried in the sand, camera focused on him, footsteps leading back out to the sea. And his last words are, I can hold my breath for a long time.
Do you think Girl Zombie had not studied her lines of the script? Because the whole time the zombies are talking, it's always, you can't kill us, you can't kill us, because we're already dead, already dead, already dead, already dead.
Well, the timing of the tides didn't work out either, so maybe she's just...
She was like an aquatic zombie hype man.
Yeah. I had, between when he's hysterically laughing, like right after that, I thought it was the end of the segment because we went to an MS medication commercial. And that's when I wrote down, I wish I'd just rented it.
Yeah.
And then it comes back and you see like Leslie Nielsen buried up to his neck. It was a very awkward edit.
What is it about this one particularly you think that it makes it your favorite of the stories?
For me, it's because it really is the one that got to me as a kid, and I know that it's the part where it's like it's just like wet cement. It's and he has to bury himself, and I guess as a kid I could just imagine what that would be like: cold cement, totally immobile. You ever have a dream where you can't like move or whatever, mm-hmm. like a powerlessness dream? Yeah. I feel like almost like this is where it comes from for me, or this movie captured that for that feeling for me, like of utter helplessness. So yeah, for me, this was by far the most horrific part. I mean, zombies and gravestones and all that, sure, but this was the most horrific part by miles.
Yeah, I spent every summer on the beach of Lake Michigan at my grandparents' house. And so being at the edge of the water and burying yourself or your brothers, whatever, was very relatable. But it's also the one death that's not really supernatural. Like, this is just, and it's cruel because you know you're going to die and it's that helplessness. But I think it's also because it's a straight up murder, but with torture.
Mm-hmm. And he makes him do it to himself, and he makes him watch his beloved, I don't know.
Or his beliked, we don't know the relationship.
It could be bridge partners, not really. Just yes.
That's what that's what he was saying. You're mine, you're my bridge partner.
Crystal, what about you?
Yeah, same. It just was always the most, not realistic, I guess, but like you said, I don't even know how to verbalize what I'm thinking. So I'll just scratch that and just say Leslie Nielsen.
Okay. That's legit. Yeah.
He's my fave. Love him forever and always. And I know someone had brought up the fart machine. Oh, yeah. Like he would play this like fart buzzer in between scenes and like crack everybody up. And I was just like, oh, to be a fly on the wall. I would have loved that.
Although if you're a young Ted Danson trying to get into your character and right before action, there's a big fart noise coming from your left, are you just going to be annoyed after a while?
Are you going to be mad at Leslie Nielsen?
I know. He's delightful.
How could you do it? He loves fart jokes so much that his headstone says, let her rip.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Canadian legend. Yeah, I think the dynamic between the two of them, Ted Danson and Leslie Nielsen, both like they're so good in their roles, and the way that they interact, that it's mesmerizing to watch. And the way that Leslie Nielsen kind of starts out like he's vaguely menacing, but you're like I said, he's just this old man in a cardigan, like he's fine, and then he becomes scarier and scarier and scarier as you just see like the absolute psychosis that he exhibits. Yeah. It's incredible.
So for our generation, Leslie Nielsen is like our goofy uncle. Mm. And so to see him, that gleeful, that playfulness that he brought to other roles, but to see it directed in towards, you know, this murder of Sam the bartender. Yeah.
Which I think Cheers actually started in 1982. Right?
I think it might have been the spring of 82, or it was.
Yeah, so.
So, yeah. But it was, nobody actually watched it until the next season. Like this, Ed Harris, like I think right after this did The Right Stuff. And then right after this, Ted Danson was on Cheers. So this was like their, you know, right before they made it big.
Once again, we return to animation as a gust of wind blows the comic book out onto the street and opens to The Crate. So we see a janitor, he's flipping a coin, which he proceeds to drop. It then rolls under a crawl space under the stairs, where the janitor then spies an old crate labeled Arctic Expedition 1834. But
first, he says, fuck a diddle.
What? He really does.
How did I never pick up on that?
When he drops
the, I missed that one too.
And it rolls under, he's like, oh, would you look at that, fuck a diddle.
Well, I might have to change my ranking now.
That's a delightful word.
I might have to use that.
So interesting, this crate, not fucking at all.
It can both be interesting, Sherry.
That's true, that's true. But we will have to wait to learn more about it as we head to a garden party. Here we meet Dexter, Henry, who is played by Hal Holbrook, and Wilma, a.k.a. Call Me Billy, played by Adrian Barbeau. So Billy doesn't quite fit in with the academia crowd that Dex and Henry move in. Dex is a zoology professor. Henry is an English professor. And Wilma just takes care of Henry, as she never ceases to remind him.
I think you should call her Billy.
It's funny because my notes go back and forth between Billy and Wilma. Billy and Wilma. So how would you describe Billy?
Just a little rough around the edges.
I would say she's... what an incel assumes someone's wife is. Like I wrote down in my notes halfway through this, everyone is unpleasant, whether it's the other professor who's trying to pick up on co-eds and like everybody knows about it, or just like her, like everybody in this movie is kind of a jerk.
Mm-hmm. I found that watching it again over the last week, I have a lot more sympathy for Billy than I have in the past.
Me too.
However, definitely rough around the edges. She's not a particularly likable person. But so the scene does a couple of things very quickly. It establishes Dex as the professor who likes to romance his students, as you mentioned. And it demonstrates that Henry and Billy are really a true odd couple. Dex is called away to take a call from the janitor who tells him about the crate he's found. But Dex isn't super excited at first. He's like, it's probably just old National Geographics. Which, when he said that, the nerd in me was like, oh my God, I would love this. But when he hears it's from an Arctic expedition, his interest is piqued, so he leaves the party to go look into it. Meanwhile, Henry is totally over Billy and her behavior, and he fantasizes about killing her in front of everyone at the garden party and getting a round of applause for it.
Jesus.
Dex arrives at Amerson Hall. They open up the crawl space, and as he tries to move the crate of the crawl space, we hear something inside thump, which is red flag number one. But he gets the janitor to help him carry it out into the lab, and the janitor comments on how he felt something shift. And Dex is like, oh, don't be silly. Like, it wouldn't feel very lively after 147 years. As this is going on, Billy is reminding Henry not to be a slob and wash the dishes after he and Dex hang out later that night to play some chess. Henry has another fantasy about killing her before she leaves for her classes.
Yeah, what is she taking?
I assume she was just going out to, like, be with someone else, whether it's friends or, you know, her Ted Danson. I don't know. I did write down world's worst trophy wife just here. I know it's kind of diminishing her, but like her character was so unpleasant, like so one note. It kind of annoyed me. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's interesting that none of the characters, like in the whole movie, with the exception of Ted Danson, are like attractive people. And I kind of like that. It makes the movie feel more real.
It's true.
If they were going to cast this movie now, it'd be full of models. Billy would be played by Megan Fox or something.
So would it have been, sorry, I just a little tangent, but the crate, the mystery crate, would it have been better if the professor who had been like sleeping with co-eds and TAs or whatever it was, if he was the one that they were like luring to his doom at the end of the crate instead of like just a nagging wife?
Ooh,
yes.
That's another thing. This movie is full of Chekhov's guns, right? Like, there's all of these little details that are thrown in that are just abandoned. You know, sure, buddy, yeah, with the matches. I can light a fire anywhere. You think that's going to play out in the climax? Nope, it doesn't.
So instead of Chekhov's gun, which you have to explain why it's there, it's just Chekhov's chair, which just belongs in the room.
Right.
I feel like if this movie also were made now, Dex is kind of the character that you feel the most sympathy for in this story, despite the fact that he romances co-eds. If it was made now, he'd be portrayed much more vile.
Yeah,
definitely.
I actually have more sympathy for the janitor, but, you know. But,
oh, yeah. The poor janitor. Yeah. I know.
But, you know, fuck it, it'll.
At Anderson Hall, the discovery continues. Both the poor janitor and Dex are pretty stoked to see what's inside. So the suspense as they're opening up that crate and they are pulling the nails out slowly and methodically, it is so good.
Mm-hmm.
The janitor finally the one to lift the lid. He says he can't see a thing. And they hear a cute little chirping coming from inside the crate. Second red flag. The janitor peers in, seeing something that he thinks are emeralds, and he reaches in, but we see a flash of green eyes just as Dex shouts no and tries to pull the janitor back. However, it is too late. We hear a loud screeching sound. The scene is washed in red light, and in their efforts to extricate the janitor from the crate, it gets knocked over. We hear a growl before the crate opens to reveal a hairy monster.
With so many teeth.
Yeah, my note was, if Pennywise and Harry from Harry and the Hendersons had a baby.
I just had a thought, and this is maybe I'm probably the last one to the party on this one. But when I saw this movie for the first time, and when I saw it just recently, I was like, it's just a sharp-toothed monkey. It's just a monster.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, generic monster. But now, Arctic Expedition, sharp-toothed monkey, is this a Yeti?
That's what I thought it was supposed to be.
It's a Yeti. Okay.
Like a really short,
I had the last one to the party. A very small Yeti.
I didn't think of Yeti, but I did think, oh, it looked just a tiny bit like a baboon. But
yeah, it does have a lot of baboon in it.
So Fluffy, as the creature was nicknamed by George A. Romero, was the first fully animatronic creature that Tom Savini had ever made. So he actually consulted for an hour and a half on the phone with one of his friends, getting some advice on how to create Fluffy. Any ideas who that friend was?
Walt Disney. Sorry, I'm thinking, who else has terrible animatronics?
So this was leftover, like, Country Bears, is what you're saying?
Is it the creator of the Monchichi?
I just talked about Monchichis earlier today.
Now that little jingle's in my head.
Can you sing it?
I'm not well.
That doesn't matter. Listen to the podcast. It was Rob Bottin, effects artist from The Thing, The Howling, and Total Recall.
Oh.
Total Recall.
Boy, he really did phone it in literally on this one. Because this was bad. Even a child can see this is a rubber suit.
It's no Quarto.
That's got to be a t-shirt somewhere.
It's no Quarto.
It's no Quarto.
So things go from bad to worse for the janitor. Because it's been, what, how many years did I say? 147? 147 years. So Fluffy has to be pretty hungry. Dex watches helplessly as the janitor is dragged slowly into the crate. And you think all of this happened because the janitor flipped a coin to determine what job he was going to do first.
Fuck it, did.
And his blood shorts out an outlet, which I don't think I've ever seen in a movie before.
So Dex runs out of the room. He runs into one of his eager students, Charlie. Charlie's not quite convinced by Dex's story and says, we shouldn't get campus security involved just yet. They might think you were drinking.
I think he says, they might think you were off on a hell of a toot.
Right.
That's right. So Dex is okay with him going to investigate. He's like, Charlie will see the evidence, which he does. But Fluffy has moved the crate back under the stairs because that's where she feels safe.
Wait, is Fluffy a she?
I've gendered Fluffy as a she. Okay. Maybe. I don't know. Paying no heed to Dex's warnings, Charlie looks under the stairs. He sees the janitor's bloody shoe. And thinking like a true scientist, he wants to analyze those bite marks.
I want that shoe.
Poor Charlie is about to get up close and personal with the teeth responsible as Fluffy attacks. And Charlie gets absolutely mauled. Like that scene where like it like claws his face.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like this was probably meant to be like the high point of the movie, like, you know, special effects wise. It's pretty good.
My podcast co-host texted a little bit earlier and said, feel free to say that the crate segment still terrifies the 14-year-old version of me. Also, my co-host John checked in.
So Dex escapes. And where does he go? To see his good friend Henry, of course. So how do you tell your friend, this ancient monster killed one of my students and the janitor, and now I need your help?
Just like that.
Just like that. You drink some booze and you spill your tale. So he is absolutely hysterical. He's talking it out with Henry, and Henry's trying to help him calm down. Dex is like, I should dump the crate in Ryder's quarry, but how do I get it there? And at that point, you can practically see the light bulb go off in Henry's homicidal head.
Yeah, he has a lot more trouble telling about the monster than he does telling about all the students he's having sex with.
He drugs Dex with another drink. Once he's passed out, Henry writes a letter to Billy before heading to Amberson Hall.
When he's like drugging the drink and like the lighting is like only on his eyes, like Nosferatu, I don't know. It was very cool.
Do you think he's always been looking for a way to murder his wife, or this is just like a spur of the moment decision? I know he's fantasized about it twice, but
that we know of. He's probably been dreaming for years.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know. As far as perfect murders go, this is not one of them. Because pushing somebody into a wild animal is not like...
Because, I mean, you don't know. This thing could be totally full and be like, I'm done for another 130 years. I'm full. And then it's just awkward.
And when the police come and they say, where were you at the time of your wife's death? You could, well, right here, just a few feet away from her, actually.
Oh, do you mean between when I roofied my friend and I mopped up a bunch of blood?
And did you push her into the wild beast? I did, but I didn't actually kill her, so I'm okay,
she
right?
She taunted me into
not
it.
Not guilty.
So the ashtray appears again on the writing desk when Henry writes the letter to Billy.
I can't believe I missed this recurring ashtray. I feel very obtuse now.
I only know about it from IMDb trivia.
Me too.
And that's I saw it on IMDb trivia and then watched for it.
So oh, okay.
I felt like I picked it out, John, on my own. If his plan is going to work, he's going to have to clean up the scene first. So it seems like a very dangerous plan. Billy arrives at home. She finds the letter that Henry wrote for her, in which he tells her that Dex has got himself into a bit of a pickle. He says that he attacked a female student. Henry needs Billy to come to Amberson Hall to deal with the situation, specifically to help the girl who has crawled into a dark place and won't come out.
And she laughs.
She's living for it.
Mm. And she's also drinking a glass of milk and pours booze in it, which really grossed me out.
What that the is hell weird. Is that?
Yes.
It reminded me of, oh, was it Mad Dog Laverne and Gloria?
Laverne and Shirley?
Sorry?
That's Laverne and Shirley and Milk and Pepsi is what I thought.
No, there's in Mad Dog and Gloria with Bill Murray and Robert De Niro and Uma Thurman, someone orders Chivas and milk as their drink.
Oh.
And I, yeah, no, thank you.
Why?
I don't know. But that's really one of the only things I remember from that movie.
You know, though, that when she reads the part where he writes, what would I do without you? She feels vindicated. She's like, it's about time. Mm-hmm. It's about time he recognizes that. She shows up on campus. She's still got that glass of boozy milk.
Oh, yeah, like she brings it in the car. It's a, not like a to-go mug. It's a full glass of warm now milk.
And I know when
she was out of eggnog.
I know in the 80s, we were all told that if you don't drink milk, your bones will turn to goo. That was not true. And so I don't drink milk. So the thought of it, just drinking a glass of milk, is kind of gross now.
Yeah.
And how did these two get on a second date?
Now that's, now we've buried the lead. How did these guys end up together?
I mean, come on. Say what you will. She is loyal to the soil. She would do anything for him, even though she repeatedly makes sure that he knows she would do anything for him.
And she would do it with glee and not empathy.
Are you saying deep down she loves him? Because I'm not sure she does.
For her quote unquote glasses, and she said, "What would you do without me?" He's like, "I don't know." And she's like, "The feeling's mutual." So there's love there. Come on, guys.
He doesn't know, but he would love to find out.
Okay, so let's imagine, what was Henry and Billy's first date? Where did they go?
Oh, he took her somewhere boring, and she told him it was boring.
Yeah, it was the planetarium or something.
It was like Applebee's. Applebee's. And she had way too many watered down drinks.
Way too many milk and whiskeys. Yeah.
It's just Jim Beam special.
I mean, I guess if you put milk with vodka and Kahlua, that's a White Russian, and that's not bad, although you don't want a ton of it. But I don't know. She is very pretty, and he is very awkward, so who knows?
I'm sure there have been weirder pairings in history.
I'm sure I've met some of them.
First thing she notices almost is the pair of broken glasses in Henry's pocket. And she's like, did he beat her? And this just adds a whole new layer to his story. And she has so many questions. But he can barely contain his excitement. And he's like, it's easier if you just see it for yourself. And he's like giggling to himself.
Yeah, they totally blows it.
He really does completely blow it.
He is giddy with the thought of his wife dying.
Because he can't do anything right. That's why he needs her.
It's true. He tells her that the girl is under the stairs, and he's like, well, you go get her out. And as she approaches the crawl space, he just shoves her in.
Yeah.
And then continues to struggle with her against the crate. At one point, basically, like, banging her into the crate as he tries to wake the creature up.
How awkward would it have been if it had never come out? It was just like, dude, I'm napping.
And how does he know it's even in the crate? Maybe it's behind him.
I mean, there's not a lot of space to hide under that staircase.
No.
I mean,
it's true.
You know, he's got a, I don't know, there's a Harry Potter joke in there somewhere.
When Fluffy doesn't wake up, he lets her go before Billy starts hitting him with her purse. And she begins to berate him, calling him a regular barnyard exhibit before attacking his manhood. Which, to be fair, he kind of deserves after the way he's just treated her.
After the attempted murder.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not the best insult, but she delivered it awkwardly. But I think she got her point across.
She definitely does. Unfortunately for Billy, this is when Fluffy decides to wake up and attack. Just tell it to call you Billy, Henry says, before escaping the scene.
He's a real Freddy Krueger precursor there with that zinger.
But at least he seems to at least feel bad about it, but for a moment, or maybe that's just the actor actually doing a good job, because Al Holbrook,
maybe, yeah, I mean, exactly.
He's really good, but yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's regret, but or disgust, but he does. It did seem like he felt a little sick about it.
He's not done yet, though. He has to make sure that Fluffy is locked back up. So he returns to the crate, takes the lock, and he just manages to get the lock on. Not locked, but on before Fluffy gets rowdy again. Luckily for him, school is in session. No one saw a thing. So he was able to transport the crate, complete with Fluffy and her victim's remains, to Ryder's Quarry, where he dumped it. So he goes back. He's telling his part of the story to Dex, who agrees to say nothing because what are friends for? And they begin playing this game of chess, and Dex is clearly feeling guilty, but Henry, at this point, doesn't seem to have any qualms about what happened, probably because he got away with it. But it also feels like he's implicitly blackmailing Dex.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
And when he says that thing about, we're going to be playing chess for many years to come, sorry, Dex. But don't worry, Henry chained that crate up so tight, Fluffy is never getting out, except that Fluffy gets out.
But three people went missing from a small college all in the same night. And it, do they not think there are going to be questions?
Well, right. Yeah. Coming home and playing chess does not mean you got away with a thing.
So according to Tom Savini, when the crate is dumped in the water, Billy's remains were actually supposed to come out of the crate. But that was deleted. And then we get a shot of Fluffy's eyes before we shift to animation. And it is time for our last story. They're creeping up on you. This segment starts with a man in a completely white, sterile environment, with the exception of a vintage jukebox. And he's spraying a cockroach on the floor. And when he washes his hands, that's where you see the ashtray again.
He's washing his hands, but while wearing surgical gloves. So I don't, like, why don't you take off those gloves and wash? I don't understand.
That's a very good question.
I mean, it's not a great question, but it's, you know, it did stick out to me.
It's a question.
Yeah.
My memory of this scene was that it was like white, 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 whiter than white. And then watching it again a couple of days ago, it was like, it's not, it's obviously supposed to be a clean environment, but my memory had made it this pristine, hermetically sealed place. And it's not, it's cleanish, oh, yeah. You know?
I think it's the room at the end, his little panic room is definitely.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so. And just like the quality of the video and everything like that made it a little dingy. Everything looks a little dingy.
That's very true. Upson Pratt is the man in question, and he hates bugs. He is a legit mysophobe, in fact. He gets interrupted by a phone call from one of his employees, George, who's calling to give him some business updates. But first, he has to listen to Upson go on about various grievances. The amount of carbon monoxide in the air, the fact that his building superintendent, how dare he, is on vacation, that he has cockroaches in his $3,200 a month apartment, which in today's dollars is about $10,000. It is a very pricey apartment.
Yeah.
George informs him that his company has officially bought the majority shares in Pacific Aerodyne, and he keeps trying to tell him that the CEO of Pacific Aerodyne has killed himself as a result. But this doesn't faze Upton. In fact, he seems pretty happy about it until he gets distracted by another cockroach. I also hope he has shares in Raid, but I have to say, his handy little suction device he has is in his computer console.
Yeah.
Oh, like an airplane bathroom.
I was
going to
say, an airplane bathroom, yeah, like the sink yeah. or the toilet.
And it all comes back to Joe Dirt, guys.
he starts to see more and more cockroaches, which does lend credence to his statement that once they get a foothold, you never get rid of them.
I did love his dot matrix printer.
He gets another phone call from Norman Kastenmeier's wife, the man who had killed himself. And she is calling to curse him, saying she will rejoice when he is dead.
That phone call. He was such a dick.
Oh, yeah.
I heard old Norman went out with a bang.
Yeah. Was this before or after the phone call to his lackey that he said to just go out and get laid and not worry about the herpes because everybody's got the damn herpes nowadays?
Oh, yeah. Wear a rubber.
Yeah, this was after that.
Yeah, right. Right.
Ugh. And, like, he just mocks this woman's pain as she talks about her husband's last moments. Like, he's just
and such then he's a like, son of a bitch. How did you get this number? And she was like, it was in my husband's right. address book, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, and just like, oh, no, I have one less loose end to tie up. I don't have to pay him to go away because he shot himself. Like, oh.
Yeah. His food processor, meanwhile, has been whizzing away in the background, and he gets another call, this time from his poor vacationing superintendent, who has finally taken his kids and his wife to Disney World. Upton demands that the superintendent send up the handyman, Mr. White, and then some exterminators, or else. He basically threatens his job. He's like, do you like your job? Then do what I'm asking you to do.
I wrote demanding old bastard.
He has a little snack. He's monologuing to himself about everyone basically being brainless bugs. They'll creep up on you before looking down in his bowl to see something. So he returns to the food processor and he sees cockroach bits in it before seeing even more in his cereal box.
So is it just bugs or is it all dirt and germs for him?
I think it's just bugs, right? But why doesn't he have more of a visceral reaction to the having eaten cockroaches? You'd think that he would flip out.
Yeah, because he has the gloves before we see the cockroaches. I wrote, and I'm not proud of this, I wrote in my notes, does he cry with shame after going to the toilet? Because he seems like everything, like any little thing would gross him out.
At this point, Mr. White shows up, but the two of them talk through the door because he won't let anyone in his apartment. He says opening the door could let all kinds of bugs in. Mr. White says, I should be able to get the Pirelli brothers up to your apartment before 11:30. And not surprisingly, based on the way that he has been so far, but we learn that Upton is also a racist, mm-hmm. saying to Mr. White that people like him can go far in the service industry.
Oh, and they have a weird, he has a weird people too.
I kind of loved it.
Yeah, and even the way that they sound like talking to each other is distorted.
Yeah.
Once he leaves, he starts squishing and spraying bugs, saying he knows what to do with a bug when he sees it. He grew up in Hell's Kitchen, so you know he knows what to do with bugs. And as he looks at the window, he sees a blackout hitting the city. And when he turns around, there are cockroaches literally everywhere, coming out of every nook and cranny. It's so nasty.
Yeah.
This is the story that, although it's not my favorite, it is the one that I have the most visceral reaction to. Like, even just talking about it right now, I'm like, my skin is crawling.
Yeah, I've lived in some shitty apartments.
And then, of course, his apartment loses power, which to me, this is an absolute nightmare. All these like cockroaches around and you can't see. Mm-hmm. So he hits his emergency power button and then he calls the police saying, what do I pay you for when they don't answer right away? And he is furious when the officer is like, we can't help you, buddy. Like, he eventually hangs up on him. So he reaches back out to Mr. White, who is now stuck in the elevator. And that sink full of cockroaches, like literally overflowing with them, is the worst. It's absolutely awful.
Yeah. And he calls Mr. White a black bastard. And I just wrote, in 1982, it could have been worse.
That's true. That is true.
I'm so glad it wasn't worse.
He manages to get himself into his panic room. It is free of cockroaches, or so he thinks. He sees is that a couch or is it a bed?
I thought it was a bed.
Yeah. It's got a blanket, so it's got to be.
So he sees this blanket rustling, and then he gets another call from Mrs. Kastenmeier saying she hopes he dies. And he removes the blanket, only to see hundreds of cockroaches on the mattress. Now, does he have a heart attack from this and die?
I don't know.
Or does he just pass out?
I'm going to say that that was not a bed, but his fainting couch. And that he could not handle. And he said, oh, my stars, when we weren't in the room, and put the back of his hand to his forehead and just passed out. Yes.
It's more horrific if he faints, right?
Yes, I think so. And then he's eaten alive by bugs.
So the lights start coming back on and Mr. White rings the doorbell. And when he doesn't get an answer, he taunts him with, what's the matter, Mr. Pratt? Bugs got your tongue?
And I wrote down, live your life where people don't rejoice when you die.
Yeah.
Words to live by. Yeah. Yeah. We see Upton lying on the bed, and there are things crawling under his skin, and he starts to slowly bleed as roaches start crawling out of his mouth before his skin starts to split, and roaches are just spilling out of him. And I would say the panic room's probably filled with about 2 to 3 feet of cockroaches.
It's an amazing amount of bugs.
Oh my
God. It really is. It really is amazing.
Apparently the most expensive part of the movie, according to George A. Romero. At Fan Expo in Toronto in 2015, he said that the cockroaches cost 50 cents a piece and they used more than 250,000 of them.
That's crazy.
Oh my God.
I wonder what inflation means how much that would be today. I haven't priced cockroaches in a while, so I don't know.
Some cockroaches were definitely harmless.
Oh, yes.
Of this film. Oh, God. Yeah. We hear Mr. White say, bastard, before we return to animation, Mr. Pratt's body enveloped in roaches, and another gust of wind blows the comic book further down the street where it lands on a nearby curb. And we're back where we started. We're back in suburbia. It is garbage day. One of the garbage men notices the comic book on the curb, and he shares it with his buddy, played by Tom Savini. And they look through the ads.
I was wondering where he was because I wasn't sure. Yeah. Okay.
This was one of my favorite moments when they throw the garbage into the truck. And as the thing closes, they yell, chew your food before you swallow.
Yes.
They love their jobs.
They do. Then they look through the ads. They point out that somebody's already sent away for that authentic voodoo doll. Inside, Mom and Dad are getting ready to start their day, but Billy hasn't come down for breakfast yet. Dad didn't sleep very well last night. He's got a stiff neck. Maybe he shouldn't have been so mean to Billy because Billy is upstairs sticking needles in his brand new voodoo doll.
Which Ben Gay will fix, according to the wife.
Yes. That's right. I love that.
Billy's pretty sadistic, really, as we alternate between his dad in excruciating pain and Billy gleefully stabbing that doll. We get one more shift to animation as we get a shot of Billy holding the doll before we transition to the creep, holding up the comic book and laughing as a candle goes out. The end.
Take a bow, fellas. What a movie.
I realize how many times I wrote gleefully or giddily in my notes, and I'm like, there's a lot of like gleeful and giddy like evil in this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about this movie that is good, but there's something about this movie that is good.
Yeah.
There's so much that is bad, but it somehow works. And not just as a kid, even rewatching it as an adult, like it's got something. I guess it's got, you know, quote unquote heart or something.
Yeah.
I think it knows what it is. Like it wants to just be like the version of those comic books where it's a little gross, a little funny, a little scary. And I think it knows what it is. I wish it had a little more nuance to the characters, but yeah.
Yeah. There's just not enough time in an anthology to like really get to know your characters, I guess.
You take like Creepshow 2, and I don't want to spoil any future episodes of Scaredy Cats, but it doesn't, like, it's got a bigger budget. It's got better, you know, technology available, but it doesn't, I think it's not nearly as good as this one.
Right.
I haven't seen Creepshow 2, but I know that there's The Raft is in that, based on the Stephen King short story. I've read that short story.
Yeah.
And I've heard that's the highlight of Creepshow 2.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true.
Yeah.
I was going to make a joke about Jordy Verrill not being nuanced enough.
Well, I also have in my notes about Jordy Verrill that he's human equivalent of googly eyes. And then it's a it's a one-man show with fake teeth and cocaine.
100% lots of cocaine.
Yeah.
So body count. So if we can't. Okay. So we have four in Father's Day. Because we have, if we're not counting evil dad Nathan, who died before the story starts. So we have Sylvia, Bedelia, Mrs. Danvers, and Hank.
I think you do count Nathan because you did see him die. It was in a flashback.
Oh, but okay. I could see that. All right. We'll go with five for Father's Day. This is gonna rearrange my whole count.
I'm sorry. It's okay. I'm just gonna be a pedant about it.
One in Jordy Verrill. Two in Something Tied You Over. Three in The Crate.
Mm-hmm.
And one in They're Creeping Up on You. So 12.
So do you not count Leslie Nielsen in Something
to Oh, I forgot about
Tied You Over.
Well, see, I don't
use Well, we don't see it.
You don't. He is still alive when it ends, so that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Maybe he can hold his breath that long.
Maybe. Exactly. Maybe. In terms of anthologies, well, where would you rank it in terms of anthologies?
For me, it's impossible to be objective just because this, you know, I saw it way too young. It had such a bizarrely strong effect on me. I can't separate that and give this like an objective look. So I have to let you guys do all the lifting for me on this one.
I don't know how many other anthologies I've seen. I saw Trick or Treat, but that was years ago after a lot of beer, and I don't remember much of it. But this one, I mean, it's good. It's definitely one voice. It's got a tone that goes throughout, and I don't know. I liked it. There's a reason that people still talk about it, because even though, yeah, we can joke about Jordy Verrill, there are a couple that that stick out and are pretty affecting.
Yeah. I agree. Like you said, it does kind of have heart. I think Ebert nailed it when he said that they, you know, had great affection for the source material and the, you know, a lot of respect for comic books and horror movies as a whole. And I think it is a really fun watch. And I don't know, as far as anthologies go, it's probably one of the better ones.
I learned that the comic book for this actually came out after the movie, mm-hmm. which is the opposite of what I thought, but it came out as merchandising.
Right.
Was there any other merchandising, like, you know, Jordy Verrill breakfast cereal?
I think the breakfast cereal would be the, like, the Upton Pratt breakfast cereal.
Right, true. Upton Pratt breakfast cereal.
Soy cockroach.
Jordy very weed killer.
Oh, yeah.
Canned milk can. And rum.
Birthday cake candles. Oh, sorry, Father's Day cake candles.
Right. For all your Father's Day cake needs.
I think, Steve, you hit on something. You said, like, that it really, like, has a similar tone. Mm-hmm. Some anthologies don't have that, right? Some anthologies feel kind of, like, chunky and a little broken up, whereas this is very much solidly one voice, one tone. You can really imagine, like, flipping through a comic book and reading all of these stories in the same comic book. And I like the little, like, connections in between. Like, I like the, you know, here's the ads that you would see in a comic book, or here's the letters that you're going to see in a comic book. I liked those little pieces that tied or segued things from one story to the next, rather than just, here's the end of the story, now we're going to start a new story. I thought that was really effective.
Yeah, I think the other one I was trying to think of was Tales of Halloween, which I didn't... Some segments were much better than others. I think this is one of the few anthology movies where it was the same writer and director for the whole thing.
Right.
Like, yeah, most of them, right. It's just, like, essentially just a collection of short films that they threw together. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps this.
Anything else you want to share about Creepshow?
I think it's interesting how the characters are, almost all of them are, like nasty, cruel, like, there's almost no likable characters in this.
Including the child, like, the most, like, at the beginning.
definitely including the child. Like, I'm not sure I can name one character that's, like, a good person. I don't know. Can we name one?
Well, this is my creep show.
The janitor. But even him, I mean, he is a blasphemer. And I'm offended.
I'm trying to figure out how fuck-a-diddle is blasphemy. What church do you go to?
Yeah, even like Ted Danson, like, you know, they're having an affair. They're still doing bad.
Yeah, but they're both in it together. Like, it's not like he abducted her. So, like,
yeah.
They're
in love, but but still, like, horror movie rules. That's plenty.
True. Even in the wraparound story, it's like the kid is evil, but the dad, like, within the first 2 minutes, smacks him so hard it leaves a giant mark, and the wife is just like, he's
total enabler.
He's having a bad day. It's like, well, I think you're all having a bad life. Like.
What about the garbage men?
I was just going to bring them up. Yeah, they were innocents.
They live.
They love their job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I assume they're good at it.
They should have gone on to be the hosts of Creepshow 2.
Oh, that would have been good.
They're the wraparound. They're the connective tissue.
Yeah.
All right. So how many scaredy cat screams would you give it on a scale of 1 through 5?
Okay. Adult me, 1. Child me, all of them.
I think I'll go right in the middle, give it a 3, because it is very uneven. And I don't know how scary I found the last story. It was just more gross.
Yeah,
I think a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, I was going to say 3-2. It's not quite scary enough to be scary. It's not quite funny enough to be funny. It is, like, a good watch. I enjoy it, but I wouldn't be telling people to watch it like I would recommend Joe Dirt.
Stop it. Just stop.
So is your podcast just like breaking down Joe Dirt minute by minute? Are there any other David Spade movies I should check out?
No. Yeti was great.
What was great?
The Wrong Missy.
Oh, I've never seen that. I've never even heard of that one.
No.
I'm searching your podcast on Podbean right now. It's called What's the Dirt on Joe Dirt?
Is it the Dirt on Joe?
That's right.
What's the Dirt on Joe?
I think I've seen most of Joe Dirt, and I just, yeah.
It probably doesn't hold up. I haven't actually watched it in like.
It's fine. We all have those movies. Yeah.
I did find a show called What's the Dirty Shirley, which does make me interested.
I bet you. What? I bet you scotch and milk is a drink called the Dirty Shirley.
I thought you were going to bet me a scotch and milk.
I will lose that on purpose.
I will bet you a scotch and milk. Does that mean you think it's going to be good or bad? I can't work it out.
Either way, it's a gamble.
Okay, so what? Tell us more about this. What's the Dirty Shirley, or what's?
Well, that's fine.
I need to know now.
No, this is a podcast about other podcasts. Let's see. 230-something Shirley's just adding a few splashes of vodka to their everyday milk. Just kidding. Join us as we try and make sense of our life choices and bad decisions.
Oh my god, a Dirty Shirley is a drink. It's an adult Shirley Temple cocktail.
Oh my goodness.
Same.
So what, I mean, a Shirley Temple is just, wasn't it just like cherry and Sprite?
It's grenadine. And it's Sprite or lemon lime soda. So this one just has vodka in it.
Oh, okay.
It sounds delicious, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds better than whiskey and milk. Oh. Yeah. All right. So tell us where we can find you, and tell us about your podcast.
Well, you can find me in my basement. And my podcast is Drunkter Who. It's where I'm watching New Who for the very first time, and my friend, who's been a lifelong fan, we drink some beer and watch the Doctor Who episodes and talk about it. We just finished Peter Capaldi's run, and I think today we released our look back on it. And I'm SRDAHLIN, SR Dahlin on Twitter, Letterboxd, Instagram. I guess you could find me on Facebook if you want to do that. I don't know. Yeah.
And would you commit to an all whiskey and milk episode?
I mean, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Malort, but we did do a season where we did a shot of Malort in each episode. And I described it on the episode. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm doing this to your podcast, Sherry, that I described it with a flower that had a urinary tract infection. Malort is a uniquely Chicago thing. There are YouTube reaction videos to people taking a shot of it. And it's one of those 4 out of 5 people are grossed out by it. So,
okay.
Oh, it's not something I thought I was going
to
bring up.
So that was a no. That was a no on committing to the whiskey. No, I think. Okay. Well, asked and answered.
I'm sorry.
Well, okay. My name's Shirley, and I have a podcast called The Dirty Shirley Podcast.
We could have made a Leslie Nielsen joke right there.
Oh, damn it.
Nuts. All right. But we'll just start again. How far are we in? We're 1 hour and 50, and you guys got time?
Let's start it all over. Tom Atkins slaps a kid.
Big opportunity missed if we don't start again. Okay, so I'm John. I run a podcast called Tale of the Manticore, and it's a bit of a strange podcast. It's an audio drama that uses classic Dungeons & Dragons rules to direct the storyline. Super nerdy, but there it is. That's my baby.
Oh, cool.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that most podcasts are super nerdy.
I mean, it's redundant.
Thank you.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's got a lot of a horror element to it too, which is, I'm a huge horror fan, and it creeps into the writing at every turn.
Love it.
So is it all scripted, or is it some improvised, or?
It's pretty much all scripted, but the story is not planned. It's all determined by dice rolling and stuff. It's easiest to get it if you just sample some of it, and you'll be like, oh, now I get it. If I describe it, it sounds weird on paper. Yeah.
All right.
And where can people find?
Oh, right. Yep. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Tale of the Manticore.
Awesome, Crystal.
Yeah, we are over at The Real Housewives of Saskatoon, where we discuss all things Bravo TV and recap episodes of Real Housewives and talk trash about reality stars. And Mostly we are on Instagram where we make some fun memes and stuff if you're into that. Mostly Saskatoon based humor. So.
And then, you were just on Sherry's episode of I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yes.
I just listened to that one the other day.
Yeah, me and my friend Michelle host the show or host our show together, and then Sherry had invited us to come and join her, so we had some fun talking about that one. That was a good one.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on today to talk about Creepshow, which I think definitely has that nostalgia vibe for probably most of us. And thank you for listening. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCatsThePodcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts, and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.